Well, this morning we're continuing our studies in the lives of Bible characters that had one thing in common. They lived during the period of captivity, which began as a Babylonian captivity, and then it continued under the rule of the Medes and the Persians, the regime who eventually conquered the Babylonians. And those folks that we're thinking about were exiled during that time. So among the exiles that we're going to be looking at were the likes of Daniel and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Going to look at perhaps Mordecai and Hadassah and Ezra and Nehemiah. In our first study, which was really an introduction, and thankfully it's an introduction that covers all of that period for all of those different ones, so we'll not have to go over that each time we begin a new character. We built our thoughts around a question. And you know that that's a method I like to use. And we'll do that for the duration of the series. So the question was, even though it was an introduction, we asked this question: what happens when a nation disregards God's law? And of course, the short answer is found in Daniel 1 and verse 2. The Lord gave the king of Judah into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. God had to keep his side of his conditional promise or covenant. And as he had said, he would have to react to his own people if they failed to keep theirs. And that's what happened. He gave his own people over into the hands of this Gentile and pagan oppressor, Nebuchadnezzar. Now, you'll remember that we covered a lot of ground in our introduction and read from many scriptures. But we actually only read two verses as a reading from the book of Daniel. So we're going to go back to Daniel chapter 1 and we'll read a wee bit further today. But just before we do, let me remind you that there are some key phrases to be found in this book. The Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men. That's an important phrase. In fact, the term Most High appears something like 13 times in the book. There is a God in heaven. That's another amazing phrase. So the aforementioned exiles that we've listed are going to demonstrate the truth of these statements as we look at their lives in our coming studies. I have a question that we're going to frame our thoughts around today, and it is this: what are we bringing to the table? What are we bringing to the table? Now let's start our reading at Daniel 1, and we'll go back to verse 1 again. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought these vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake to Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored and skillful in all wisdom, cunning in knowledge and understanding science, such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, whom they might teach the learning and the tongue or language of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name Belteshazzar, unto Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. And we'll end our reading there just at the end of verse 8. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, knows his onions. He could see immediate value, of course, in the gold and in the silver, the spoil that was taken from the palaces and even the temple at Jerusalem. But he could also see a longer-term value in human resources. So he isn't just interested in the exile's brawn or the exile's belongings. He's also interested in their brains. Now, if he's going to introduce a bunch of intelligent young Jews into his society, he's a king, remember, then he's obviously going to make sure that he finds the best looking ones, those who have good social skills and who know how to conduct themselves in refined company. In our reading there, the word children is used in verse 3, but that would, with the context, be better if it read youths. What are we bringing to the table? Well, what did Daniel bring to the table? He was picked out. He was selected. And he comes into this situation which he did not engineer. He comes into it very much, I'm sure, against his will. What's in Daniel's tank, if you like, when he arrives in Babylon? We know what Nebuchadnezzar was looking for, but what was Daniel bringing? Was it just the things that Nebuchadnezzar had on his list? What was in Daniel's own tank? What are we bringing to the table whenever difficulties arise, when change comes? Is the story of the first exiles a story that celebrates the achievement of a group of hand-picked youths who seem to have it all? Good looks, intelligence, charisma, breeding? Or is the story of the first exiles a story of something deeper? What did Daniel bring to the table? Well, that's a question we'll endeavour to answer this morning. Nebuchadnezzar had a plan. But in your mind, I know what you're thinking. God also has a plan. And Nebuchadnezzar's plan, mind you, was well thought through. He wasn't going to invite all of this foreign talent into his court so he could hear them natter on about the wonderful land they came from and about their great nation, their customs, their God. No, he was going to condition them, re-educate them, if you like, indoctrinate them, thereby turning them into model Babylonians, through and through Babylonians. The kind of specimens he would be proud to put on display to any visitors to his kingdom or palace, and could do so without any fear of them letting him down. He wasn't going to create a bunch of loose cannons. But their transformation would take time. He's thinking 3 years. He knows it will involve several steps. And we read of them in this first chapter. They're going to be given a new name. They're going to have to learn a new language. They're going to have a new outlook or worldview or understanding. They're going to be taught in the Babylonian literature and arts and history. And they're going to have to be fit for a new environment, the Babylonian court. A new name. Well, as you know, I wouldn't be too worried if I got a new name. But anyhow, I'm sure it would upset the apple cart. And folk would be thinking, who is that, if I went around with a different name? I've always found it a wee bit annoying that when we remember Daniel and his three friends, we generally refer to at least the three friends by the Babylonian names. Isn't that right? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. If I talked about them, you know exactly who I mean. But if I mention Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, you might have to think about that. Or even through the week, if I said, name me the three Hebrew names, You might have to think about that. And it's always bothered me that that's the case in our Sunday school stories, in our quizzes, in our wee choruses. It's always Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, isn't it? Although, there's probably a reason for that, because from chapter 2 onwards in the book of Daniel, the writer uses those three names. So I suppose when we're giving the story from the scripture itself, those are the names that we find. But that's odd, isn't it? Why change their names? Well, according to what's known about ancient customs, there are a couple of reasons. To be able to change somebody's name showed a mark of authority. To change someone's name was to strip them of a major part of their identity, really. Quite often it would be to strip them of a family belonging. For a monarch to change someone else's name may, however, had another meaning. It may have been that they were actually conferring a sign of favor by giving them another name. But it was something conferred at a price. By conferring that name and it being a symbol and a sign of the monarch's favor meant that you would have to have undying allegiance to the monarch. You'll see that in the book of Daniel. That was expected. Now, those reasons may well be historically true and applicable even in this case, but there's something else. The Jewish names of Daniel and his companions contain titles that are used of Israel's God. This was a common practice. Many names were composed of two parts, one a verb, a description, hopefully of the person, or what you would like them to turn out like, and the other, a title or a name of God. And both Daniel and Mishael have the word God in their name, and Hananiah and Azariah have the word Lord in their name. To change someone else's name who was given that Jewish name, that connection with the God of Israel, to change their name was to do away with, or try to do away with, that part. That very important part of who they are as a nation, who they are as a people, who they are as individuals, who they are before their God. That's bad enough. But it gets worse. Because Nebuchadnezzar was going to not leave them nameless. He was going to give them other names. And in the other names that he gives, there are references to false gods. Do you see the blasphemy that's taking place here? And this is just step one of what's happening to these young men. Daniel's name is changed to Belteshazzar, although we rarely remember that one. And that has to do with the god Baal, the false god Baal. Hananiah is changed to Shadrach, meaning illuminated by the sun god, or the god Aku, as some translated. Mishael is changed to Meshach, meaning, or we think it means, like the moon god, or like the god Venus, as some translators say it. And Azariah is changed to Abednego, the servant of, or loyal to, the false god Nego. Now, this was something which the four comrades had no control over. They could still think of each other in their Hebrew Jewish names. But they had no control over the fact that they would not be addressed as such throughout Babylon. What was Nebuchadnezzar doing in changing their names in that way? Well, if these lads were as gifted and as handsome and as charismatic as was hoped, then Nebuchadnezzar was going to make sure that any praise or glory for their success would not be attributable to the God of Israel. So you can see a foundation for what's going to happen to some of these exiles. Right there, step one of Nebuchadnezzar's 3-year plan for them. But he's rebelling against the God of heaven, remember. An example would be if young Hananiah shone above the rest of the Babylonian young men, then those reading his name would think, well, it was the god Aku, the sun god, who caused him to shine. Do you see what they're doing? If young Azariah spoke wise words and gave good counsel, if he was the go-to guy in the court, then the people knowing his Babylonian name would say, oh, it was Nego who gave him that wisdom. And our God, God of Israel, would be stripped of his glory. I think that's one of the reasons that we find repeatedly the Most High mentioned in the book. And Daniel likes to use the words, the God of heaven did this. The God of heaven did that. A new name. A new language. Oh, there's not a great deal we can say about that. They were going to be taught the language of the Chaldeans that was used in Babylon, and that would make sense. They're going to have a new understanding. In verse 4, these youths who were without blemish and of good appearance, who were skillful in wisdom, endowed with knowledge and understanding, competent to stand in the Lord, in the king's palace, they were to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The literature. Now, it's not a stretch to view this as a form of brainwashing, radicalization, if you like. However, for these bright young men themselves, this stage in Nebuchadnezzar's plan may well have been welcomed. Because here was a way in which their brains were going to be stimulated. After all, these young guys could just as easily have been sent down to the brickworks as the Hebrews were in Moses' day. But no, they're going to be able to engage their minds. And a man called Ashpenaz, the chief of Nebuchadnezzar's officials, is ordered to oversee the program. And though it might seem like a university course for 3 years, they weren't going to have to worry about what would happen at the end of it. They were guaranteed a career waiting for them in the presence of the king himself. Great prospects. They're going to have to also adapt to a new environment. I wonder how good we are at that. Do you like change? This 3-year course was away from their home, remember. This 3-year course takes them away from their family. It takes them away from their accountability with regard to religious observance. Does that remind you of something? Don't we all know so, so many lovely young people that came up through the churches in Northern Ireland, were involved in everything, until what? They went away to uni. And the question for those young people and our young people is, when that comes, when that time comes that you move away, what are you taking with you? What are you bringing to the table? What's in your tank when you go into that different environment? Because that's all important. It can't be put in there at the last minute when suddenly, oh, they're going to Edinburgh. We need to pray for them. What about the years before? It wasn't just going to be a testing environment. It was going to be a tasting environment. Never forget that. Young people, it won't just be a testing environment. It will be a tasting environment. And that brings me to another point. They were going to experience a new diet. That was the plan. Verse 5. And the king appointed them or commanded that they should have a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years. His food, his drink. It wasn't just this was to come from the kitchen belonging to the training of these young men. This was what these were the king's preferences. If the king went into the dining hall of this place of learning any given day, he could sit down and eat with them because it was the stuff that he was eating. Now, any of us that went through school would doubt very much that Her Majesty the Queen would be sitting down to eat the same as what we had was slopped out to us as a school dinner. Some school dinners were better than others. But there's no way Queen Elizabeth was having the same as we were having at school. But that's what was happening here. That's spelled out in great detail. Isn't that amazing? Wouldn't you have thought, wow, we have landed on our feet here. Can't wait till lunchtime. In recent decades, a phrase has been used in the business world as this, investing in people. Now, definitely, Nebuchadnezzar was investing in people here. He had the creme de la creme of the Jewish exiles, didn't he? And he was going to treat them well. But there was a problem. Verse 8, there's a but. But Daniel noticed something. He could get defiled. In his testing and in his tasting, he could get defiled. In being away from friends and family and religious accountability, he could get defiled. He knew that. He was aware of that. His very first recorded reaction has to do with that. Now think, this single issue was just one of many that were forced upon these young men. But there's a difference with this one. This one really appealed to the flesh. Now there's many that thing we've to go through, we would rather not experience, we would rather not have to deal with, we would rather run away from it a million miles. There are loads of things that come into our lives, and that's the case for us. But then there are other things, and they appeal to us. And it's not as easy to do as Paul would say to Timothy, flee youthful lust. So in the testing and the tasting, there's temptation here. Big time. Here's what would have gone through my head at 17 or so years of age. Because that's what we reckon that it must have been in order to tick all those boxes that Nebuchadnezzar was looking for. It would make sense for that to be the case. So if that was me at 17 and I were in Daniel's shoes, what would have gone through my mind? Well, nobody from Judah will know. That certainly would go through my mind. We didn't do anything to deserve this. We didn't get ourselves into this mess. Or maybe the one that might have swayed them the most. Surely we must do everything we can to survive, including eating the king's meat. Or we might have said, why put ourselves through any more pain or punishment? This has come upon us because of the elders in the southern kingdom. They haven't been walking with God. They haven't been setting a very good example. They're hypocrites and they've got us into this mess. Surely we can just go with the flow. They're being offered opportunities to excel in Babylon, opportunities that came with perks. But one of the perks involved breaking God's law. So Daniel isn't just bringing his good looks, his charm, his social skills, his brains, his knowledge of the sciences, his breeding. He's not just bringing all of that to the table. He's bringing something else, isn't he? What are we bringing to the table? He doesn't arrive in Babylon with that defeatist attitude. Woe is me, this has all happened to me. And he comes with something in the tank. You know, how we get through different situations in life as believers very, very, very much depends, and I can tell you from my personal experience, depends what's in the tank. What's there? Have I been feeding myself from the Word? Have I been exercising in the prayer and engaging in spiritual warfare? Have I been doing that? Because I don't know when something's just going to come smack into my life and floor me. The reaction of Daniel's very interesting. How would it be influenced? Well, because of his shocking deportation and the fact that it took place in stages, he may have been impacted by this fact as he saw his nation less and less powerful, and God more and more displeased with his nation, and God's protection more and more withdrawn because of the nation's disobedience. He may have been impacted by this. God takes his covenant seriously. He may have been. He may have seen how backslidden the southern kingdom had become, and he may have realized, well, the northern kingdom, which was far bigger, has gone that way about 130 years before. This is not good. So he may have arrived in Babylon with these convictions, and he may have stood there thinking, well, it's a serious thing to displease God, even in the tiniest matters. Or, and I prefer this, or it may even have been both of these things, but the other one is, he may have genuinely and sincerely had a strong personal faith in God. Such a strong personal walk that would make him want to please his God in absolutely everything he would say or do. It could be both. But even if it's just the latter one, isn't that amazing? That's something in the tank. That's something to bring to any table. That's something Nebuchadnezzar couldn't see, nor did he desire. But it was the best thing that any of these young men could have brought. He had a fear of God. And there was a fear that he would allow something into his life that would displease his God at a time when he really needed his God. Do you need the Lord today? I need him every day. If there's a word that he hears day and daily from me, and I'm sure he's fed up listening to it, it's not a vain repetition because it's genuinely meant, and it's this: help. I can't think of it ever praying without asking for that. Daniel has worked it out that by enjoying the Lord's favor and walking in the Lord's way, he will be in a better position to expect God's He's going to need courage. He's going to need strength. He's going to need peace. And I suggest that Daniel must have had something in his formative years showing to us that even when a whole nation departs, or a whole denomination in the Christian church departs, or a whole assembly departs, even if you read the letters in Revelation, you'll see that there can be a remnant. There can be that one. You can be that one, and all else departs, there be that remnant. What are we bringing to the table? There's much of what I've said about how defilement appears in the Old Testament, but just to abbreviate, most of the times, if not all, it has to do with religious defilement. And commentators agree that in this case, it's assumed that the meat that would be offered to Daniel and his friends would have previously been in some representative way offered to idols. And thereby that would be one way in which eating would be to break God's law. We assume that's what it was. But one thing Daniel had was a clear, sharp conscience, Godward. Do you know this material age that we live in? One of the greatest successes of the enemy during this materialistic age to the Christian church was to dull our conscience. And I'm speaking for myself. Daniel still had that. That's amazing. But there's something else. He also had a desire to make God's name known, the God of Israel, to make him known. You see, if Daniel and his friends had simply complied in every detail to the 3-year plan, and then they excelled at the end of the 3 years, then Nebuchadnezzar and his staff would pat themselves on the back and take all the credit for the success. But by quietly rejecting the king's meat, Daniel and those officers that are immediately around Daniel, so there's witnesses, were going to know that if they excel against all the odds by having the weakest, most rubbish nourishment, pulse and water, then there must be something else. And what is that something else? It's someone else. It's the God of heaven. Here, he may not have realized it, but I think he maybe did. He had a desire to make known the God of Israel in this foreign land to these Gentile people. And here was a way of doing it, by refusing the king's meat. And he's able to say with faith, but if we flourish, he didn't know what they would be like even after 10 days. If we're as good looking, in fact, if we're even better looking in 10 days, you'll know that it was the God of heaven. So he's even interested in his testimony. He's interested in pleasing God. He has a sharp conscience, Godward. And that's what Daniel brings to the table. Daniel doesn't arrive with an empty tank. In there is faith. May the Lord bless these thoughts to all of our hearts for his name's sake.